name is Kathleen Hurdy.
And my name is David Hurdy.
And we're going to talk tonight about sharing hospitality and talk a little bit about frontiers of partnership in relation to the whole concept of hospitality. We indicated earlier today when this was announced that we would be starting from a scriptural base. I think this evening we actually started from a very wondrous base of Holden hospitality with this feast. If this feast was a foretaste of the feast to come, we're in for a real treat. This salmon dinner was absolutely stunning. And hospitality has taken many shapes and forms at Holden. And so in this kind of a setting to discuss hospitality is not a big challenge. Think through with us about your understanding or your memories of stories from both scriptures, Old and New Testament, that suggest hospitality. What are some of the stories that come first to mind?
Abraham.
Same old Abraham was welcoming the visitors, the strangers. Okay, others. That was in, I don't know all of these passages, but...
I think it's in...
Yeah, this one is Genesis 18, when
she
Abraham...
She knows the Bible very well.
Oh, yes. Other suggestions. Pardon?
You got a cheat sheet?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, right.
Well, the one I think of, it isn't a specific episode like that, but Jesus' words in the Matthew 25.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, the...
Inasmuch as you have done it unto the least of these.
Inasmuch.
I always like
the hospitality of the stranger is one of the five or six case illustrations.
And I always have liked to think of that in terms of the incognito Christ, how Christ is the hidden Christ. As Luther talks about God being hidden, you know, in life, and we discover that.
Other examples.
Emmaus
disciples on the road to, remind me of the specific scriptural
Luke.
Passage there.
It's Luke, and it's way at the end.
Luke at the end.
26, maybe, I'm not
I
sure.
I think it is, 26, 27, something along in there. We'll give it a guess.
I'll look at your Bible.
Okay. Again, the hospitality along the road to Emmaus, when in many respects the host-guest aspects were switched, and the people walking along the road were joined by Christ and then invited Jesus in to have dinner together. While you're
24.
Looking, Luke 24, all right? And then there's that, going back to the Old Testament, that Leviticus 19 passage. Dave, do you want to read that one?
That's the one that we at Seafarers, in fact, if you want to look at it, you can see the little, did you get a copy of the newsletter? The most recent newsletter? I don't know if you did or not. We quote that, it's the one from Leviticus 19. Leviticus is not one of my favorite books, but it does have a few goodies in it, let's put it that way. When a stranger sojourns with you in your land, you shall do him no wrong. The stranger who sojourns with you shall be to you as a native among you, and you shall love him as yourself, which I think is a... We felt that that's been a particularly meaningful kind of a statement for us at Seafarers International House because of its welcoming the stranger into our midst.
There's a wonderful passage in Hebrews as well, Hebrews 13:2, where the angels are, where you entertain angels
unaware.
This week I've been reading... Dakota, which is a spiritual geography by Kathleen Norris, and she tells the story of the Benedictines community in the Dakotas and talks about this, their welcoming and the hospitality there in the monasteries. But she tells about this one old priest who has, or from the Benedictine monastery, who has given all sorts of evidence of welcoming, always welcoming. And but there is, she says, the ability to get tired too and weary. And she said the Benedictines tell about the time they see a stranger coming down the road. And one turns to the other and said, "Is it you again, oh Christ?" And the weariness of being a
Do I dare mention?
Sure.
Yeah, go ahead.
Please.
This potentially raunchy one, Rahab.
Oh, tell us. Yes.
Tell us that.
Yes, Rahab was quite generous in a unique and raunchy way.
Now, read that.
Okay, I just got it. It's Joshua chapter 2. Joshua sends these two spies in before they move in to the promised land after the death of Moses. So they went and entered the house of a prostitute whose name was Rahab and spent the night there. And the king of Jericho was told, "Some Israelites have come into the land to search us out." And the king sent orders to Rahab, "Bring them out." But the woman took the men and hid them. And then she said, "True, the men came to me, but I don't know where they came from. And when it was time to close the shop, why they went. You pursue them if you want. Maybe you can overtake them." However, she brought them up on the roof, hid them under stalks of flax that was laid out there. And so the men pursued them, thinking they're all the way to Jordan, but they never found them. And as soon as the pursuers who were going after them had gone out, the gates were shut.
You know, there's something about that that conspiracy of hospitality there, that quality that is a part of the story of Anne Frank as well, the Dutch family that welcomed Anne Frank in, that kind of being taking a risk of being hospitable making sure that people are safe in spite of. It's a quite remarkable story. We could go on, because the whole scripture, if you look at it through the lens of welcoming grace, is certainly a series of stories of hospitality. I think of Elizabeth and Mary and the exchange of homes in the time when they most needed each other, the time of birth and labor and birth and waiting, the hospitality there. Certainly the hospitality of the Lord's Supper is a weekly celebration for many of us, or in some disciplines daily, others less often. But that hospitality again of the table, the banquet table, the foretaste of the feast to come. Well, our focus tonight is to talk about hospitality as both mission and ministry, and as both giving and receiving. There's a very interesting group of thinkers who've written quite a bit about hospitality, and I'm sure you won't be surprised when I mention Henry Nouwen, or Henri Nouwen, as one. He certainly has done a lot of work on the vocation of host, and he again begins to tie together this guest and host concept as one. His book, Reaching Out, The Three Movements of the Spiritual Life, deals with this theme particularly, although it certainly touches on it in a number of his other books. That book is in this library, but it was checked out, so I couldn't pick it up to show you. Parker Palmer, whose work has been particularly meaningful to me. Parker Palmer has a doctorate from UC Berkeley in education. So we have something, though I didn't know him at the time. I was there at a different time than I. But he has written a lot about education and learning of the faith. And a book that I particularly like of his is the book Knowing as We Are Known. Knowing as We Are Known. But tonight we're going to use his book, The Company of Strangers, as well as a reference. In this book, he's talking about Christians and the renewal of America's public life. This book was written in the early 80s, and his challenge here in this book is that the stranger can be quite the spiritual guide to each of us, which is quite a new notion for me. Coming across that notion, the stranger as spiritual guide. But when you think of the interaction on the Emmaus Road, or the interaction of entertaining angels unawares, the stranger in many ways, that part of the stranger is the public with whom we share space, government, action, land, resources, that stranger can also be a guide in our thinking. Both of these people build on the idea, if you take a little look at the word study, and Dave's going to go into this a little bit more when he gets to the work of John Koenig, but the word xenos is the Greek word, which is a root word for hospitality. We see it more in the Latin word hospes, which is the Latin for root antecedent for hospitality. But xenos and hospes both carry the notion in the original form of guest and host. In fact, in xenos, guest, host, and stranger are wrapped up in that theme. And xenophobia, you recognize, comes from that same word, fear of the stranger. Or philoxenia, which is really getting closer to the idea of hospitality itself. So those are terms that are background linguistic roots of hospitality.
Do you want to call your attention, actually, to a book. You know John Koenig, do you not? He's a graduate, I'm sure, of Concordia, and has, of course, taught now at the seminary of the General Theological Seminary. I think he's become an Episcopalian, actually.
Well, they pay better.
Yeah, right. That's trouble.
What's his name?
John Koenig. But Koenig, K-O-E-N-I-G. Okay. But he did a work on this whole idea of New Testament hospitality several years ago. And so if you want a book that kind of gives you a basic biblical study, basically a New Testament study of the whole idea of hospitality, this is a very helpful one. He goes into the beginnings of the use of the word, of course, hospitality in the Greek, and then he goes through and shows how hospitality is a kind of underlying theme throughout the whole New Testament. He says here in his opening chapter, I think it will be clear that hospitality does indeed form a major substratum of the New Testament, full of promise for the faith and mission of the contemporary church. And then he develops how you go through the life of Jesus and the mission of Jesus, and how so much of the work that Jesus was doing was done in the context of hospitality. We think of Jesus' visit to Mary and Martha. We think of Lazarus, for instance, the brother. We think of Jesus eating with sinners and publicans, and reaching out into the community that the normal straight-laced rabbi probably would not have ever reached out to, and how that was a very basic part of the way in which Jesus carried out his mission. It was a matter of hospitality. Then he goes and shows how Paul also in his missionary journeys, and how the house churches were welcoming to Paul, and how there was give and take in the whole missionary endeavor of Paul in terms of carrying out the gospel to the Gentile world, that also is a part of it. And then he uses Luke and Acts as a kind of vehicle for bringing out this theme of hospitality. I'm not going to go into a whole book review here for you, but if you are going to do anything, I know you indicated something, if you were going to be working on this theme in your parish next year, that this might be a very helpful book for you to look at. And then his bibliography touches on several other resources that would be helpful. This book is, by the way, in the library here. So anyway, John has done a very good job, I think, of setting forth the idea that hospitality is a very fundamental means by which the gospel, both in the early, not in the only in the Old Testament, but in the New Testament, was a very basic theme. And I think we've seen how a place like Holden is a way in which the gospel has been, you know, generated through the life of the hospitableness of a place like this. And there's probably many other examples that we can point to in the life of the church through the centuries, that, like you say, the monasteries were places of hospitality, and many of them became sort of the generating of hospitals in our society. I mean, those were really the medieval places for development of the hospitable style of life. So the Christian life is one of hospitality in many ways. So that's what I'd like to share at this point.
To pick up a little bit on Parker Palmer's comments about hospitality, this idea of outward and inward and public and private, the word public, as Palmer describes it, contains a vision of our oneness and our unity as people, as the family of God, and particularly the family living in interdependence upon one another. So that to accept the fact that we are strangers, but we are one, is really almost a very challenging thing to think about. Despite the fact that we are strangers, he says, we occupy a common space, share common resources, have common opportunities, and must somehow learn to live together. Think of that in terms of a global society, how challenging that is today. To acknowledge that one is a member of the public, and we are public people, we are public citizens, global citizens, citizens of this country, certainly citizens of the state in which we live, and yet we are in that respect dependent on all others who share that common citizenship. Hospitality to the stranger, Parker Palmer says, gives us the chance to see our own lives afresh through different eyes. Have you ever had that experience? Have you met someone who has helped you understand yourself better? How did it happen? What were the elements of that experience? We had a well, you're go ahead. Someone listens to you, and when they listen to you, what burden does that place upon you?
Well, I just found it helped me get some things
clear in your own mind, right? I think often when we know that someone is listening, paying attention to what we're saying, that it helps us clarify what we're saying then in that regard. One Sunday afternoon, I think it was, a fellow came into the church, or Sunday after church, I guess it was, in Oakland, when we lived in Oakland, California. A fellow came into the church and said he'd really like to have a family to live with. He was a student at the English as a Second Language school at the College of Holy Names. And after completing 2 months living in the dormitory, if they could find a family to live with, they would be allowed to live off campus. And so Dave tried to get somebody at church to accept Mohammad Giasfand from Iran. And it ended up that though we had 4 kids, there was, you know, the we were the ones who had a spare corner, and we took it. Well, I'm telling you, it has, our lives have been entwined with him in ways that we would never have predicted. was Muslim and Zoroastrian in a sense.
Kind of had more of an intellectual approach to it.
Right. Came from a strong family background. His inquisitiveness and yearning to know more about how we lived as Americans and about the Christian faith was provocative, because then, like you say, he was listening to what we said, we were listening to what he said, and we had to be very clear with each other.
Well, he was hospitable in the sense that he even came to church with us. Mm-hmm. He came to Bible studies, participated in the activities of our congregation. I mean, we never put any pressure on him, you know, on trying to, you know, convert him, so to speak. But he seemed to fit. I mean, there was a kind of a willingness to become a part of our community.
And
how's that?
You learn better that way.
Yeah, and we said, and our children, I think, even benefited, because there are some commonalities between Muslim and Christianity, or Islam anyway, and the Old Testament particularly. And so, you know, he helped talk about things like that, which our children were able to get kind of a first-hand exposure to another faith. And he lived with us for about 6 months, I think it was.
Right, and then kept coming back frequently over the years while he was doing his
graduate studies,
then went home to teach at the University of North Tehran, and we did visit him. Actually, we were there before the revolution. It would have been more difficult after. But we did visit while he was still home doing a summer study reprieve at Tabriz, and just fascinating. And the guest host interaction continues. It's mutual learning kind of situation.
Now he has an opportunity to go to St. Louis and teach at the university there.
To do a research project at Washington University, and he's seeking to come as soon as he can come. He's working on papers, and we're working with him on that.
Well,
we will. His field is microgenetics, and he has defined a population of a family tribal group in the very remote part of Iran that has congenital blindness. And he is working to do research to deal with that problem. And there's a researcher talk about a tiny world. I talked with this researcher because we're working with Mohammed to get his papers in order. And she has offered him the research post to do the work. She's interested in similar topic. And she said, I came into this country as a refugee, and Church World Service, National Council of Churches, helped to resettle me as well. It was just really a wonderful story. Now she is in turn helping him get settled in. We had hoped that we could talk a little bit about the whole idea of seafaring ministry as an example of hospitality, because that particularly in a global society where people are on the move all the time, and where most of our products that we use in our ordinary daily living, and often our food, comes to us transported by others, and in many cases those are seafarers. So Dave's going to talk a little bit about the seafaring ministry.
Yes, some of you have already picked up some brochures about Seafarers International House, which is an agency, an institution that actually had its origins in 1873 under the auspices of the Augustana Church at that time. And so they were basically originally a immigrant house. Interestingly enough, even back in the 19th century, the Lutherans, even though there were different Lutheran groups, worked together. And the first 20 years that the pastors of the Augustana Church were serving there, basically Swedish church, they were working with the Germans in Manhattan for over 20 years. And the immigrant house was actually a joint ministry between the Scandinavians and the Germans. So they were welcoming basically immigrant people, helping immigrants into the country, which was a natural thing, I suppose, for the churches to do. We have gone beyond that, of course, today. I mean, we no longer have a lot of Scandinavian and German immigrants. We're helping Iranian and people
South American,
from
and South Central America,
and from other people.
Czechoslovakian.
I mean, the churches. We don't deal so much with immigrants at our place. Once in a while, we get people who will stay with us. Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Services will call us up and say we need a place for these people to stay while they're being helped through the processes in New York. So we do have immigrants that stay with us occasionally. But Seafarers International House has sort of gone through the different stages of being hospitable to different needs as they have arisen. And so after immigration subsided, then it became a house more for working with merchant seafarers, people from all over the world. And we work very closely in an ecumenical context also today. We work with Roman Catholics, we work with Presbyterians, we work with Episcopalians, we work with whoever happens to be involved in seafaring ministry around the world. And one of the organizations that we belong to, we belong to two ecumenical organizations. We participate in the International Christian Maritime Association, which is international in scope. There are something like over 700 ports in the world. And there are some forms of ministry, Christian ministry, in most of these ports, although I think there is something more like 275 where there's really a center that exists, that is a Christian center, where there's either a Lutheran, Roman Catholic, sometimes they're ecumenically oriented. So we do participate in that organization. And then here in North America, we are a part of the North American Maritime Ministry Association, which is both Canada and the United States. And the work that we do focuses mostly on a presence, a Christian presence, a Christian pastoral ministry to these people. I would say there are differing opinions, I think, in terms of whether or not you are more overt in your attempt to evangelize people, and some places there is a more open attempt to do that. Some pastors, some chaplains seem to be more eager and more maybe even adept at being aggressive, I would say, in terms of their evangelistic approach. But I think the genuine hospitality comes when you can be kind of just yourself and be there as a presence, being of help to people who come and are in need of maybe help, just human help. But anyway, counseling is a lot of our work with people. We have seafarers that come and many times are concerned about various sorts of problems that they have. We do have Christian worship. We have a chapel at our place, and we do have seafarers that come and share in our Sunday worship services. One of the factors I think that's very basic to the needs of seafarers is in keeping in touch with their families. Many of them are at sea for 6 months to a year sometimes. And nowadays with containerization, which means that the ships are loaded, you know, by these big containers. I don't know if any of you have seen the ports now where they have these large loading equipment and they can load a big container on a ship. They can bring a ship into port and unload and load within 6 to 8 hours. And many times the crew can't even get off the ship hardly. country. The Coast Guard won't even let them have any kind of a shore permit because they're afraid, you know, some of them will escape and, you know, become illegal aliens, as they say. So there's a hesitancy to even let them off board ship sometimes. So our chaplains get permission to go on board ship and to visit with the crew, the staff on the ship, and seek to bring materials many times, devotional material. They may even bring magazines, newspapers, things of that sort that interest the seafarers, because reading material is a very basic need. We have a supplier over in New Jersey who gives us umpteen thousand German magazines. We have three chaplains that do ship visitation at our place. Two of them are German, and they go over and they bring all these magazines from this German newspaper importer, and they bring those on board ship, and the seafarers just really appreciate it. We try to just be helpful to these people as they have needs. We have a fax machine, and we'll get messages from the ship sometimes before it comes into port, asking if the chaplain would get something for one of the people on board ship. They now have computers, and so maybe they want a particular software package. So our chaplains go buy the software package and bring it to the ship when they arrive in port. Sometimes they come on board ship. They need to get to a shopping center in just a short time, and we have a van that will carry them to a shopping center where they can do some shopping while the ship is in port. So that's kind of the ministry of visiting the ships. And it would be wonderful if we could even have lay people visiting ships. Some ports have developed that, and we haven't been able to really get that going at our center. But that's something, if you live near a port, you and are interested in doing something like this and getting involved in something, you certainly could volunteer as a lay worker and ask if you could be trained to help do ship visitation.
Many of the seafaring centers around the world also have hospitality centers where people can come in some of the ports where they don't have the overnight accommodations as seafarers in New York has. They have the centers where they can find a place to do some recreation.
Right, we have that. The Seamen's Church Institute, which is the Episcopal Church, has a center like that at Port Newark, which is the port for New York and New Jersey. And the seafarers can get to that center rather easily, but they don't have any overnight accommodations such as we have in New York City. But one of the things also that's very helpful is even being able to make telephone calls. A seafarer gets off of a ship, he's many times they are worried about their families, especially the Filipinos, and because they're gone for long periods of time. So one of the real just basic needs is to communicate. So providing telephone service to seafarers is one of the very fundamental things that they really appreciate. They'll come into our place in New York City, and you know, we place telephone calls for them. We keep track of the number of minutes, and they pay for the call, but we provide the kind of service that is necessary for keeping in touch. Some of the places have libraries where they can pick up books. We have countless people bringing us paperbacks all the time, and our chaplains take these paperbacks onto the ship. You know, we just are a supply source, you know, for books that the seafarers need when they go on board ship. At Seafarers International House, we have a 100-bed hotel, all for all practical purposes. We have about 40 to 50 seafarers there every day who use our facilities for overnight accommodations. We have about four or five who are really sort of semi-retired, if they aren't already retired. They keep saying, well, I'm going to go to sea again, but they don't yet. And they stay with us almost on a permanent basis. But many times seafarers come to New York just in between jobs. They have no place else to go. Many of them have become completely almost familyless. We are their family. Our place is their home. They use our place as their address. They get their mail at our place when they're away at sea. Many times they will leave us a forwarding address and we will, you know, send their mail to some other port where they can pick it up. Just recently, one of the fellows that comes to our place all the time just got a job, left the very day he left. We got word that his brother had died. And so, you know, he was already on board ship, but we got in touch with the shipping company and informed them that his brother had died. But he decided, you know, well, he couldn't get off and come back, but he, you know, it was good that we were able to give the information to him so he was aware of it. So we have those kinds of things that we provide.
Can you say something about the gifts that seafarers bring in the guest-host relationship?
Well, I think one of the things that they do bring to us is to remind us that we need to be hospitable as people. And that that we are here to be a kind of responder to the needs that they have. I think often we, in our relationship with people, we forget that we are here to be people who are responding to the human needs of people, and I think that they remind us of that. Mm-hmm. Did you have something else?
Well, I was thinking too of some of the stories that you tell about some of the things that are broad in terms of understandings, new understandings, both their own cultural perspectives, and also their appreciation, which is a gift in itself.
I think one of the things that we try also to do, not just in terms of being caring about their, you know, daily needs and things of this sort, but also about the justice issues that exist in terms of the whole area of seafaring. If you have the newsletter, you might just look on the front page here, at the very bottom, we have a seafarer who's living with us right now, who has been a longtime seafarer, and right now a lot of the ships are reflagging, and they're flagging out as U.S. ships, and so jobs now are going to be increasingly difficult to get, because they are, if you read the article, he's a good writer, and we invited him to write an article for the newsletter describing the problem confronting seafarers. So this is the kind of a sharing that they do. If you open the page, our German pastors also have described how it's the same thing is happening in Germany, that the ships there are also being reflagged. And so, therefore, the whole issue of being sensitive to the economic problems and injustices, and of course, this seafarer calls attention to the fact that what shipping companies are trying to do is to exploit third world or so-called third world people, getting people at very low rates of pay, and exploiting them as well as, you know, causing a job problem for people in the United States.
So that the reflagging process means that instead of being flagged in the United States and having to meet the safety and health and employment standards, wage standards of U.S. Companies, they can go diminish those standards and thereby, sadly, exploitation does occur.
I would say also this ministry, unique to the seafaring ministry, is that it's a ministry that deals in the workplace. It is a workplace ministry. We are, and not only do we at Seafarers International House, but in the International Christian Maritime Association and in the North American Maritime Association, there is a concern for the working conditions that exist in the maritime industry, and trying to be advocates for the seafarers who are often the ones that are exploited. And so therefore we do work very closely with the maritime unions and try to be, you know, somewhat collaborative with the seafarers. Now that doesn't mean that we don't also try to appeal to the corporate and companies, but it's a matter of balancing, you know, the concern for both the maritime shipping companies as well as for the working persons in the maritime field.
Do you have a question? Do you encounter instances when the owners of the ships will not allow you on board because they don't want to see what's going on inside the ship?
Yeah, let me say that I think that there would be reluctance on the part of shipping companies if they know that the chaplains are coming on board with an eye to seeing problems that are not fair or problematic. Now, the Coast Guard is supposed to do that. The Coast Guard are supposed to go on board ships and check them when they're in port, and the law of maritime law allows them to arrest a ship if it does not meet certain standards, even if it's not a U.S. ship. If it's in a U.S. port, if things on board a ship are not up to standards, they can actually arrest a ship.
Does that include labor?
Labor conditions also.
Labor conditions?
Yes. This is another area that's a problem in the maritime industry, is that many times, especially when you get labor from Philippines or someplace like that, they maybe even will have two sets of books. And they'll keep one set of books that is up to the standards of the contract where they claim they're paying fair wages. But then they keep a second set of books, which is really diminished wages. They're not the great wages that have been agreed to in the contract. When a ship is at sea, a seafarer is intimidated from ever raising an issue like that. And many times when they've come into port, they're almost fearful to call it to the chaplain's attention. But there have been occasions when that has happened, and there are some maritime attorneys that have been bold enough, you know, to really take these cases into consideration. And ships have been held in port until these kinds of issues have been resolved. Sometimes they don't even pay the crew. And then, then they will hold the ship and try to resolve the conditions before they let the ship out at sea again. So there are some problems like that with unsavory kinds of shipping companies. But it's not a common, everyday thing, but it's an occasional situation that does exist. And that's one of the things that the chaplains try to work with.
But generally, you don't have a problem getting on board.
No, I don't. I haven't been aware of any real problem like that. I, There are so many ships that come into New York also. You know, we just can't begin to cover the entire gamut of ships that come there. So our pastors, our three chaplains that do visitation, have kind of almost developed a kind of a pastoral ministry with certain ships. And they expect the pastor to be there and to come on board when the ship is in port, because they've gotten accustomed to having the pastor there. In fact, we've got one pastor who visits a ship that has some Muslim crew, and the Muslim crew call them pastor when they come on board, because they've developed that kind of rapport. The Seamen's Church Institute has a department of seafarers' rights, and they deal a lot, not only with the problems that exist in New York itself, but from all over the world. Now with the communications that we have nowadays, if there's a port someplace else in the world that has a problem, they will contact the Seafarers' Rights Department of the Seamen's Church Institute and to get assistance in dealing with that. And they have attorneys on their staff who actually do deal with some of the economic and injustices and so forth, the problems that exist.
They're also doing some work in training interns to go on to ships as well, because there just isn't enough pastoral.
Yeah. Especially now with the opening up of the East and a lot of the ports in the East being opened up, there's a training program in New York for chaplains, and we've had several from Russia, from the port of Odessa. And an attempt to try to help them to understand how a Christian ministry is carried on. And so it's an attempt to try to bring a Christian dimension to the work.
There were a couple of other frontiers of partnership. We're just about going to have to wind up, but we wanted to just very, very briefly talk about two other frontiers of partnership. One is the whole area of welcoming the new immigrant. Those of you who live in California, anybody here from California, know that there's been a very challenging time in California in many respects. The immigrants are not being welcomed into the state. Through Proposition 187, there has been a lot of constraint put on on teachers and people who work in hospitals, saying you can't serve the non-citizen, and that's presented major problems. We won't have time to go into that particular project now, though I will be beginning some work in that arena through a Rockefeller-funded grant to look at the ways in which churches are welcoming immigrants and to find new models of encouraging church folk to take seriously what it means to be hospitable to the stranger. So we're going to be working on that this next year. Dave wanted to also talk a little bit about the frontier of hospitality to those who are physically challenged, physically or mentally challenged, which is a whole other arena of hospitality. Do you want to say
just a few words? Of course, most of you are aware of the Americans with Disabilities Act that has come into play, and many churches are not, there are certain aspects to that law which do affect churches, but basically the church is excluded. So that means that we as members of the church have got to do it on our own, not by law, but by just love and concern for making our churches more hospitable to the needs of the disabled. There's a couple of resources over there. Jenny Thornburg, I don't know if you know who I'm talking about. She's the wife of the former
Attorney General.
And she has a program that's moving into, you know, particularly developing relationships to the developmentally challenged.
Jenny herself is very much interested in welcoming people who have mental disabilities. She has fought for the right of her son and the welcoming of her son into the community after an accident. He has had some major problems, and her story is one of a mother whose hospitality has now enveloped all of us because she has gotten together a group that's working on these resources.
And there's and she's particularly concerned about the religious community. I mean, it's focused at the area of helping churches become more open and concerned about that. In New York, we have a group called the Open Congregation, which is trying to get churches to be more hospitable to people. Not just the physical barriers for mobility, but all aspects of disability, helping people who are sometimes excluded because of all sorts of conditions, the mentally challenged, the emotionally challenged, and of course the blind and the sight impaired and the hearing impaired, as well as the mobility issues.
There are many aspects to hospitality. We've opened up the topic anyway for all of us together. Let me close with just a word from Parker Palmer. He says, "The stranger of public life becomes the spiritual guide of our private life. Through the stranger, our view of self, of world, of God is deepened and expanded. Through the stranger, we are given a chance to find ourselves, and through the stranger, God finds us and offers us the gift of wholeness in the midst of our estranged lives, a gift of God and of the public life." So recommends Parker Palmer.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for coming.